Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 10th, 2002. This session is Global Economics in a Sacred Universe. This will be presented by Michael Scott. Why don't we listen in?
Thanks to all of you for coming and sitting inside on a day like this. Hi, Carter. That's my nephew out there. So he's... He might lecture. My name is Mike Scott. All of you were here yesterday, pretty much. Was anyone not here yesterday? Okay. Hey, what is? Well, good. There's a couple different things we can do today. But I'm kind of interested in, first of all, my assumption is that many of you already sort of have in your experience and so on, you might call it a little bit of eco-theology, or where it is in the scriptures that we get, you know, that creation care is an important part of the Christian tradition and so on. But that's something we could spend a little time on if you feel like it would be helpful to you in your own life, but also in, I'm assuming people here also get in conversations with people back in their own communities and churches, and that it might be helpful to you to have a variety of things thrown out in case there's something new. So that's one thing that we could spend a little time on, is do people have interest in that? Could I get a spending 10 minutes on that? Yes, no. A little bit of interest here. Yeah. And Carter really wants it, I guess.
He's leaving so quick.
Yeah, he's out of here. Okay, well, if I did some of that, I would try and go through it fairly quickly to give you some. I think it's helpful for folks when they're back in their churches to have some ready answers if they don't feel like they do already, because some of this stuff gets challenged, as you all know, in local congregations. And then the bulk of our time, I thought we would move on to talking about our economic system and compare it, in a sense, with nature's economy, human economy and nature's economy. And how is it we might move toward reflecting nature's economy more in our own economy? And how might our own lives and also our culture be changed to do that? And perhaps we can do some brainstorming around that. Did anyone have anything else, let's say, from yesterday or from what I've just said, that they were kind of hoping that you'd like to talk about today? Anything from yesterday or... Okay. Well, let's start with a prayer, a little quietness, and I'll say a prayer and a brief meditation with doing a couple readings. Goodness to us, for this beautiful day, for the food we've had, for our friends and family here, and for all the good folks we get to meet here. We give you thanks. Amen. So, the title today is Global Economics in a Sacred Universe. So maybe to start, we'll talk a little bit about sacred universe. Our Martin Luther writes, God writes the gospel, not in the Bible alone, but also on trees and in the flowers and clouds and stars. or we could turn to Psalm 148. Just a piece of it. Listen to who it is that's being called to praise the Lord. Praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures and all ocean depths, lightning and hail, snow and clouds, stormy winds that do God's bidding. You mountains and all hills, fruit trees and all cedars, wild animals and all cattle, small creatures and flying birds, kings of the earth and all nations, you princes and all rulers on earth, young men and maidens, old men and children, let them praise the name of the Lord. And then from Phil Sherard, who's he's passed away now, a British poet and Greek Orthodox theologian. In the ecological sphere, the message is clear, however much we may try to ignore it. While the effects of our crisis are most evident in this sphere, the crisis itself is not first of all an ecological crisis. It is a crisis concerning the way we think. We are treating our planet in an inhuman, God-forsaken way because we see things in an inhuman, God-forsaken manner. And we see things in this way because that is basically how we see ourselves. So Sherard is suggesting that we basically see our world as profane. And Janine would be, and others would be much better at, you know, the trajectory of how we came to that kind of worldview. That eventually, when push comes to shove as well, we have an economic system that sees everything finally as resource, not as sacred, not as an expression of God. So that's why Sherard is saying, fundamentally, the ecological crisis is a crisis in the way we think. And it's a crisis in the way we perceive ourselves, one another, and the rest of our community, when community includes the non-human world as well. What are some of the ways you all experience the world as sacred, and or scriptures that support that view? You can just sort of throw out things as they come to you.
Or you mentioned last time White.
Lynn White, yeah.
I think when you look at Genesis 1 as an example, and last time we mentioned the issue of dominion, mm-hmm. Well, when you construct Genesis and where God, Moses, is saying people will have dominion over the earth, that was before, quote-unquote, sin. So we were in the image of God and perfect and would be treating the earth in that manner. We have lost that, just as you've indicated, that we are human-centric. I'm not calling it the fall. I'm not willing to call it that. But we have lost our image of God. God is in us. We are part of God, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, so before the fall, dominion, we would have exercised dominion in a way pleasing to God, and that would be a nurture of all that is, and respect. It's true that after the fall, in the Noahic story, for example, after everything is, all of creation is supposedly, you know, wiped out except for what's on the ark, right? And the creatures come off the ark, and Noah and his descendants and so on are not given the commandment to have dominion, or are not given the right to have dominion. You don't find that language there. Similarly, in Genesis 2:15, there's another creation story. There's Genesis 1 and there's Genesis 2. They're both creation stories. Genesis 2 is actually written 400 years before Genesis 1. In Genesis 2, you have Adam and Eve being put in the garden to till and keep the garden. And the word till in Hebrew is abad, which shows up in Numbers, the same word. As for me and my house, we will abad the Lord. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Adam and Eve are put in the garden to abad the garden. And if you look in the most literal translations of scriptures, it will have serve. Adam and Eve are put in the garden to serve, and then often it's translated keep. And Cal DeWitt talks about, a biologist and theologian at the University of Wisconsin, talks about that word as you can keep things in different ways. You can keep things on a shelf, like a cucumber in a pickle jar. You can also keep a cucumber in the garden and nurture it and keep it in relationship with all that is. You can keep something physiologically. And DeWitt says it's this sense of keeping that is was the Hebrew's understanding of that word in that verse. So we're put in the garden to till, to serve and keep physiologically the garden. Perhaps you could call that the principle of earth keeping. And this is from Cal DeWitt's work. And again, back to dominion. In Hebrew culture, a king is one who had dominion, right? Kings were the ones who would have such authority. And a good king in Hebrew society was one who exercised that dominionship with mercy, justice, and compassion. It's a different connotation of than we often think of when we hear the word dominion. What are some other things that you all draw on from scriptures, let's say, to that would back up in a sense, maybe we're saying an ecological ethic, but also that the world is sacred, a worldview that the world is sacred and not profane. If indeed that's maybe the root of our problem today.
On the opposite side, I guess we look at, Lutherans, et cetera, look at maybe there are other species in the world, but our more conservative friends seem to think, and even though they don't maybe agree with evolution, but feel that the entire earth is here for our use. But I can't remember a number of the verses that I know there's some in Deuteronomy and whatnot, but I can't remember ones that address those issues. But obviously we're interpreting parts of the scriptures to substantiate what we are doing.
Right, and that's also what I'm doing here. I'm pulling out examples. I mean, the one that's most often talked about, though, it's interesting, is dominion. In any conversations I get into anyway around this stuff, it's always the dominion verse. It's just interesting that that's the one that people most talk about, when in fact we could talk about Genesis 2:15 just as well as serving and keeping. Or we could point out that the first creatures given the commandment to be fruitful and multiply are birds and fish, actually. I didn't realize that until I read Cal DeWitt's little book, and it's like, oh yeah, sure enough. Earlier in Genesis 1, it says, creates the birds and the fish, and then it says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And we're also given that commandment. Bill McKibben suggests that, well, that's the one commandment we've obeyed. Now let's get on to the rest, you know? So, another way to look at that commandment, that we have fulfilled that, and now it's time to also allow, in a sense, then the degradation of the environment and loss of species, the inability of certain species to continue their existence because of our actions, is our intervention in not allowing other creatures to fulfill their God-given mandate to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So there's that fruitfulness principle, as Cal DeWitt calls it anyway, from Genesis 1:5, I think it is, somewhere in there, where all creatures, these other creatures are given the commandment to be fruitful and multiply. We could talk about Sabbath in Leviticus when God says, I'll give you this land, but every 7 years you need to let this land lay at rest because it needs that rest. And I guess what I'm trying to get at, and then Psalm 148, which we read, all these various parts of creation, all praising God. And humans are in there too, but it's not like we're the only ones doing that job. Indeed, when the rest of creation's ability to fulfill its commandment to praise the Lord is diminished, then the song of praise that goes up to God is lessened, or goes out to God, because I believe God is indeed all around us, and part and innervates creation. So that what I'm trying to get at is, you know, this, what is it we sense that the Creator would, how would the Creator wish us to treat his or her creation? And I think the principles of earth keeping, of Sabbath, begin to speak of a God that is concerned about more than human and concerned about the well-being of all creation. We can move into the New Testament. Colossians 1:16-20 is this sort of hymn of praise to Christ. In him, talking about Christ, in him all things hold together. Through him all things were made. And in him all things are reconciled. All things are reconciled through Christ. It doesn't simply say humanity is reconciled. Or John 3:16, the very famous verse. For God so loved the world. It's a pretty good translation. That the Greek word there is cosmos. For God so loved the cosmos that God sent God's only Son. In my growing up, I heard that verse, for God so loves humanity. And sometimes it felt like, for God so loves parts of humanity. So this sort of, you know, enclosing around of the circle of compassion around a few, as opposed to, for God so loves the whole cosmos. So the sense of Christ coming to redeem all creation is another thing that I like to mention to people from Colossians 1 and John 3:16. Are there any other things people want to throw out?
Well, just a quick little, growing up, the image of the Garden of Eden, I think as a gardener, I understood that we were to care for our world because I'm a gardener. So that was a good
image
for me. Unfortunately, many people in the world don't live in a place where they can garden. But I think people who garden, people who are in touch with the earth, probably have the idea of caring for the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in that Sabbath tradition besides letting the land rest, mm-hmm. as well as people rest, mm-hmm. on the seventh year. Then there's also the 49th year when all the land was to be restored, and it says the reason for that is because the land belongs to God, not to people. And we're just using it. And then there's other parts of the Sabbath laws that include being in partnership with the animals, like that we use to care for the earth, like not muzzling the ox while they're grinding the grain with their hooves. If they're doing that service for us, then we respect them by letting them munch while they're doing that. But that, so, you know, embedded in all that tradition that's in the Bible, but it's coming out of a rural society where we kind of gloss over those things, but the grounding of all of that is a really respectful, ecological, and in other kind of justice,
yeah,
and just kind of law.
Yeah, thank you.
He said something about our body being a temple, and we should take care of it. I think we lack in that respect also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you want to say a little more about that?
No.
Okay, because...
I saved my short sentences, but...
Thank you.
Hopefully they got the meaning, I don't know.
Yeah, to see one another as sacred as well. I mean, Sherard's piece goes on to say we essentially see ourselves as, you know, two-legged animals bereft of any sanctity, and all other creatures bereft of any sort of sanctity, and certainly not treating ourselves as the temple of God. And indeed, we speak about Christ indwelling. We speak about accepting Christ into our hearts. We speak about God as being within us, not only external to us. And to follow up on Dan's comment about, you know, the 50th year, the Jubilee year, how the land, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but I believe if a farmer had sort of gathered other farmers' land around him, he was to let the land go back to its original owner. Isn't that right? In a sense, combating the adding of field to field to field, and the ownership, quote-unquote, ownership of land by one person. So that after that, at that 50th year, others were allowed to have their land back. So it's all tied into this, to economic justice as well. The Sabbath year, the Jubilee year, of restoring the land to those who need the land to survive. So there's both economic justice and ecological justice within that whole Sabbath and Jubilee tradition.
We had that in our political laws years ago, I think, where companies couldn't monopolize. I don't see it happening anymore, but it just seems like they weave the smaller, like I'm thinking of grocery stores, and they just keep weeding the smaller person out.
Well, agribusiness in our state is becoming more and more popular, and the small farms are dying.
And where are you from?
Wisconsin.
Yeah. Let's come back to that, because I thought we would move into now talking about the economic system. And so if we would agree that this universe is a sacred place because God created it, because the earth is the Lord's, because of these things we've been talking about, because of this belief we have, this sense we have, that indeed we are, the Spirit is within us, and that God is both immanent and transcendent and so on. If we buy into that, if this is a sacred place, an expression of who God is in some way, then it seems to me our economy ought to be something, ought to be construed so that it reflects that. But I want to compare sort of how nature works in its economy and how our economy works, and see if we might then brainstorm about ways we might move toward reflecting that sanctity within our economic system. So, Mom, you've seen this, and Dad, you've seen this a couple times. You might want to come up here and do this instead. My mom and Dad have seen this before.
Go ahead.
So you can leave now if you want to. So on the top, this came about... As I was asked to write an article on the connections between ecological degradation, poverty, and overconsumption. Ecological degradation, poverty, and overconsumption. And it seemed to me like, well, why do we have to write about that? Isn't that kind of obvious? But the fact that people are writing about it means it probably isn't. And one of the reasons that it may not be clear how connected those things are is that we don't see our economy, the human economy, as embedded within nature's economy. We tend to see our economy as external to the economy of the natural world. So what would be the characteristics of these two economies? Nature's economy, first of all, just going to write a few things down here. First of all, waste equals food. And so I've put waste in quotes because there really isn't any waste. Nature is the most efficient and the first recycler. And we see that here at Holden. There really isn't any waste food here because it's going back to the compost and eventually back to the gardens and so on. I guess here all food waste is actually not waste in the way we think about it. It's also a closed system except for solar energy coming in. Essentially what we have here is what we're limited to, whereas the human economy says, well, we can go anywhere to get any resource and sees itself as open. And the final thing related to closed systems that it draws on local resources. Coming down to the human economy, on this side we've got capital. And I should just say I'm not an expert in this stuff, but I don't think we can leave it to experts.
and
people that don't necessarily know economics really, really well, like I don't, but I think we have to ask questions of how things are going in order to raise the consciousness of all people so that we can ask economists to answer the questions of externalities, for example, which we'll get to right here. You've got on one end capital, labor, and resources. Labor is just you and me, right? And resources is everything up here. Resources is the rest of the natural world. So basically have the earth down here, right? And created wealth and capital. Put into one end of a line. It's not a circle, it's a line. And at one end you've got all this, and at the other end you've got a lot of stuff. And goods and services, and a lot of which we need, a lot of which we don't, because in the middle, of course, we've got lots of advertising and media. And then I've left one thing out. What is that? Or I'm sure a lot more than that, but just in this schema.
Externalities.
Yeah, externalities, or the waste.
Pollution.
So down here we have waste equals externalities. And isn't it interesting that word? I mean, our language reveals our worldview in many cases. And so this language of externalities reveals our hope and sense that these waste products are external to the system. Like, oh yeah, there was all that stuff that came out of the factory, but we'll just put it in the river. Or an externality of growing potatoes in Idaho with a lot of fungicides and herbicides and so on, so that they're all the same size and that they can be marketed to McDonald's. An externality of that would be groundwater pollution, so that much of the groundwater is not fit even for human consumption in some communities in Idaho, even for irrigation eventually. What's that?
Tailings.
The tailings are an externality right out our door. So there's, and obviously we've exceeded the natural world's capacity to assimilate all those wastes, all those externalities. So I think no matter who you are, and no matter what you do, and if you teach or whatever, you know, bring that up. I mean, this is a theological issue, it's an economic issue, it's a biological issue. I've gone to freshman classes in college and people have had, you know, economics 101 and they haven't heard the word yet. Or at least they don't remember hearing it. maybe they were asleep that day. But we need to be talking about externalities and their impacts on the world. Now, just any questions about this model? By the way, I mean, someone said to me once, you know, this arrow ought to be drawn up in here. It is true, it is indeed within the earth. But it seems accurate to me to try and to draw it outside, because we kind of hope in some ways that, and treat our economy as separate from nature's economy.
Well, it's tremendously different. I mean, nature's economy is a perfect system, if you look at it. The human economy is certainly not.
Anything you'd want to add to either these circles or the line? Or, and I hope partly this is helpful too, as you think about how to talk to others about these issues of sacred economy and a sacred universe, and how our economy is structured not to reflect that. Because finally, I mean, corporations, and we're not, I don't wish to demonize anyone or any institution, but our institutions are set up to eventually treat communities. Let's look at how communities are treated down here. Communities are first a resource for production, right? In the eye of a corporation, not the eye of the CEO necessarily, but the eye of the corporation treats our community, and by community I'm including non-human in that. So when you hear the word community today, remember it's non-human as well. As a resource for production, community is a resource for production. It's then a market over here, a market for all this stuff, a market for consumption. And then thirdly, it's potentially a sink for the externalities, a waste site for the externalities. And so that's how communities get treated in this system. Whereas here, communities, in a sense, are enriched and encouraged to be, because they are still rooted to a place. Classic example here in this part of the world, Doug Firs on the west side of the Cascades. They do well in a lot of water. But in a particularly rainy year, they can't say, I've had it, I'm going over the east side, where the Ponderosa Pine are hanging out in the nice dry weather. They're, except essentially for the air and the hydrological cycle and the weather systems, they draw on local resources, so unique communities are born and nurtured in each of those places. And that's true of human communities, too, that are still largely dependent, more immediately dependent upon natural resource base. The Kalahari have a very different culture than tribes in Borneo and so on. So go ahead.
One thing that just entered my mind was the scariness of all this nuclear waste. We have two plants within 75 miles.
Yeah.
And everybody wants the electricity, but they say, don't bring the waste here, send it out to Utah or somewhere. And that's got to be an issue. No matter where.
Right, and what a lot of that points to is I'm trying to remember this. It'll come to me. About the precautionary principle. David Suzuki is a writer who, and from BC, he's a geneticist, and when he's talking about GM foods, for example, he points out that things like chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, nuclear energy, Agent Orange, DDT, these are things that at one point were like, wow, this is really good stuff, it's going to solve a lot of our problems. So we release it into the environment before we really know what its effects will be. And now we're starting to reap some of the benefits of those, or the results of those experiments, in a sense. And he then argues, in the relationship to genetically modified food, that we ought to be very careful about releasing genetically modified seeds into the environment because of the precautionary principle. So nuclear waste is, and those are all examples of externalities, aren't they? And one other characteristic I want to throw out here is how individuals are perceived. here in these two economies. In nature's economy, and this is John Cobb, the process theologian, and who spent the last 30 years of his career really looking at economy and ecology and how where the two met. And he says that under nature's economy, we are persons in community, which in Christian language sounds to me like we're created to be the body of Christ, created to be in relationship with one another and with the rest of creation, this sort of complex web of relationships. Down here, what do you get called sometimes as an individual down here?
Expendable.
Consumer. A consumer. Expendable. Anything else you get?
A number.
A resource.
You know, when I call Group Health, my healthcare facility in Seattle, they say, "Hi, what's your consumer number?" And I would say, "Well, my name is Mike." And I pause, and then I give them my consumer number. But it's just an example of the view, essentially, of who we are. Individuals in a market is what Cobb says. And this is, of course, what drives a lot of the McDonaldization or Walmartization of the world, is that the more alike places are, people and cultures and so on are, the easier it is to fit into a line. If you have a lot of diversity and variety in a place, people who and people who don't necessarily buy into this, it's harder to get them to agree to become capital, labor, and resources. So, I found that a helpful model, personally, for thinking about our economy and nature's economy. Anyone have something they want to add now?
Mike?
I'm about to kill part of nature's economy. Mike? Oh, yeah.
There are tribes down in the New Mexico area that just disappeared. So one of the problems with the nature economy is that sometimes the resources dry up with drought and so forth, and the whole community disappears. So when that becomes a problem, then it's nice to have resources outside that closed system.
It is, particularly if you're those people. And so you... do you know when is this example happened, or can you tell us a little bit more about it?
I don't remember the details right now. Well, another example is my Norwegian ancestors came to this country because Norway just could not support a food system. It didn't have enough growing ground as the population increased. Mm-hmm. They couldn't support that community, so they came over here.
So there's certainly, I mean, if we were to move toward modeling this entirely, I mean, would we want to? Is a good question.
I think a better question would be, could we? Could we survive the way our products are being? I'm thinking food resources are being made,
yeah,
practically made.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be hard to change, but it would really be nice if we could. What I've seen coming across this country from Wisconsin, a lot of beautiful land, but then we run into areas where reservations. The Indians were living in little trailer houses. You could see they were put together by scraps of lumber, like a little addition that they had put on. They were rich in one sense. They had about five or six cars in the yard. But I bet only one or two of them ran. And for most of us, we don't keep a car long enough to change the tires. I mean, to buy a set of tires, I should say. By that time, we bought another car. My wife made the comment, the Indian was supposed to respect the land. They had a lot of respect for the land. But look what they're doing to it. And I said, but you got to remember that they're poor. Where do they go with that car that don't run anymore? Do they take it somewhere where it's going to cost them some money to get rid of it? You know? So a lot of what we see is maybe a false image of the people themselves. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any people around. That was one of the things that I was almost tempted to stop and talk with some of these people, but I didn't see anyone. But apparently they were all working for somebody, I don't know who. But I just didn't see any families around. Although I see that in the rich communities also. During the daytime, there's no one around. They're big houses, but there's no one in them. They're working to support the big house, I guess. So these are... I don't know if we've gone too far to be able to come back and support the amount of people that we have in this country.
Well, certainly, I mean, this course or this workshop will end up talking more about our consumer habits and American culture, because that's who we are and who I end up talking with. Certainly, I mean, population is another big question in terms of carrying capacity of the natural world. And we're certainly exceeding certain thresholds of the carrying capacity of the natural world already. And it's projected we'll have another 3 or 4 billion on the Earth before we plateau out. So, so moving toward our economy reflecting the sanctity of the natural world will be difficult and will require difficult choices. And there will be some who will be hurt in that process. I think we need to accept that. But we also need to realize that what we have now is hurting a lot of places and people. And there are choices we're making about, you know, right now that are causing pain for many. And what I'd like to get it, when you talk about the global economy, you know, you open up a huge can of worms, because it's sort of like everything we have, is that's how we get it essentially now, is, you know, the average piece of food travels 1,200 miles to get to our plate. I'd like to talk about signs of hope that of things people are doing that I think reflect the sacred universe within our current economic system. Because we can't go back. I mean, whatever that means. And when you talk about simpler living, some people immediately think about, you know, going and living on the farm, let's say, or as Dale has talked about, living in a cabin somewhere and heating with wood and having an outhouse. And that's not what I'm talking about. Some might feel called to do that. And indeed, we need to have a lot more farmers. But we need to make it economically possible for there to be a lot more farmers. And people, I think, would be drawn to it. And I think it's a very honorable profession. But we need to go forward using, you know, the best of our technology and the best of our ideas, probably. But we need to do so in a way that begins to create circles, it seems to me, and not lines so much. And so here's a great example of a circle. Using, you know, the market system, using capitalism, they're making money. it's a carpet company in Atlanta. It's called Interface, I believe. Has any of you heard of this company? Let's say these carpets were from Interface in Atlanta. They would be renting Holden Village these carpets. And when they wear out, they come up here, rip them out, bring them back to the factory and reuse the carpet and make new carpet. And then they come in and lay down new carpet, but it's fully recycled. There's a movement in business to move this way. And partly because it's just seen as economically more smart. Because you begin to move your system toward not having to buy so many new inputs all the time and not having to deal with so much waste. Because at least some businesses are wanting to deal with their waste responsibly. And that costs money. So there's an example of a modern day corporate culture creating a circle within their own subsystem of the economy. I just went to Oberlin, Ohio in August, where David Orr headed up a project to construct a green building for their environmental studies program. They recycle all their human waste right on the property. So you flush the toilet, and it goes into a green machine that basically uses a lot of plants and cycles through about 7 different tanks and goes back to the toilet. They
green water.
It's a little gross, right?
You need the plants.
But I went to the bathroom there, and the water's very clean. I checked the toilet out. And they produce about 65% of their own energy. And this is a fairly cloudy part of Ohio, with 4,700 square feet of tiles on their solar tiles on their roof. And he just goes on, and it's a learning building. He says, like, if this was the floor we'd walk on, there would be a drop floor below there where you could just lift up these panels and get at all the plumbing, all the wiring, everything right there very easily, so that as technology increases your ability to be more efficient, you can just, your building learns as it grows, as it becomes old, gets older, and as time progresses. That building was built competitively with what it would have cost to build a normal building today. So these things can be done. CSAs are another very exciting example. Any members here of community-supported agriculture farms? There are apparently about 1,000 around the country now, and they started here in 1986. I mean, the first one in the United States was in 1986. I'm a member of one of these, and I pay a certain amount in March. Like, for me, it was about $200 in March to this farmer, the gardener, who these people have 450 shares on their one in their garden that they sell. This woman and her colleagues grow my food, and it's about 15 miles out of town, something like that. So at least that chunk of my food comes from within 15 miles. And I also have a small garden, so that's about 200 feet. My mom and dad grow so much food, it's amazing. But anyway, so every week, the CSA bags up stuff that's ready and brings it to a central point in town. And I go there on Wednesday night at 5 and pick up my CSA food and bring it home and enjoy the food for the week. And it's a model that's very exciting because it acknowledges that we're all part of agriculture. Our current food economy just sees us as food is one more thing we need as consumers, and doesn't point out the fact that we're indeed participants in agriculture. Wendell Berry calls us industrial eaters, as opposed to participants in agriculture. And whether we realize it or not, we are indeed participants, and this sort of reconnects that relationship for me. And knowing who's growing my food, at least a part of it. And it also spreads the risk of farming around. So that if we didn't get enough rain in Seattle for a year, and this garden didn't produce very much, I wouldn't get as much produce. But this woman who has gardened this place for years wouldn't go out of business. Or if there are 2 bad years in a row, she wouldn't go out of business. What if she did go out of business? Well, for one thing, she and her colleagues wouldn't have work. But the other danger is that that land, which most CSAs are close to urban areas, that land would then become prime real estate development property. So it's another way of keeping urban growth in check, or at least keeping some land close to the urban boundaries in agriculture, not condominiums or houses. So there's all these benefits of supporting local farmers through, for example, CSAs. And just briefly throw out, some congregations are doing it. Community-supported agriculture, well, congregations are already communities, aren't they? So you could have, some CSAs are supported with 40 to 60 subscribers. You've got 40 or 60 families in most of your churches. Someone wants to farm, can you come together and say, let's support you. Let's support you. You will be our farmer. And then you also have an obvious drop-off point. Sunday morning, you come and you celebrate the Eucharist, but you also celebrate being given the bounty of the earth, the food for the week. And we have some churches in Seattle that we work with. One of them has bought 10 chairs. One church bought 10 chairs, and they bring it on Sunday morning, and about 40 different people divide it up. So you go into Fellowship Hall during the coffee hour, and they serve fair trade coffee too, by the way. But their families like, dividing up the food, and it's just a real celebration. And you think of what that church is teaching, and sort of the implicit curricula of that church. If you were to go there, you would see fair trade coffee being served, and you would see people dividing up organically grown veggies, you know, and you begin to say, well, what's that about and why? And that's a way for your church, for any church, to teach that we care about creation, we care about farmers, we care about those growing our coffee, and so on. And Holden serves fair trade coffee, too. And you notice, too, their food philosophy, more and more of their produce is coming from local areas, and they list the local farmers that they support here.
Once you described it, I realized we have one run by a group of nuns, and they also have a retreat center.
What's the name of it?
Feast of Green Bay in Denmark. I've been out there on a little daily retreat. And you pay so much in the spring, and then you get produce and so on. And they raise chickens, and they have llamas. And
some of the CSAs, you can get things like milk and honey and berries and not only veggies, depending on the size. Yeah.
They make envelope homes.
What's that?
Envelope homes. They're double walls. And on the exposed side to the sun, they'll make like a foyer. And we're inside that foyer, then they build a masonry wall that'll absorb the sun's heat. Mm-hmm. In the evening, this warm air rises and goes around this home, helps heat the home. I've worked in a couple of homes like that, but they're more expensive to build. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, it probably save a lot of resources.
Anyone who hasn't had a chance to say something yet today, or give an example of how we might shift our autonomy toward reflecting the circle more closely?
Well, rather than how, what's going to force us to do it? Because the technology's there, and what you described has been done for years. Solar housing, mm-hmm. I have a solar house, and I built that in the early 80s because of the energy crisis. So these are all available, but what's going to force people to do this? We have in our area recycling facilities, and that's because the availability of landfills gone. This little town of Grass Valley ships it out of the area up to Redding or to Nevada. We no longer handle our own trash in that area. But that's because the government has said to us that you've got to stop putting so much trash into landfills. So that's forcing people now to recycle. And so what's going to cause people to change their habits of consumption?
Do
Do you have ideas?
Well, I think cost is going to be one of the factors, perhaps. You know, as products increase in cost, perhaps that will force people to change.
And that, I'm glad you said that, because that reminds me of accurate pricing, in a sense. I mean, the extra, what I think we'd want to do is we would want to, I mean, force is a strong word. I mean, how can we begin to change the economic system so that the information flowing through the system is different enough that people's behaviors begin to change? Because often what motivates us is the price we pay for something, right? And so if in an example of a French fry, let's say, the French fries cost $1.20 or so at McDonald's right now for a normal size or something. What would it cost to really cost to pay for the externalities of how that French fry got to McDonald's? So if you would include the cost of the degradation of water, groundwater, for either human consumption or irrigation, if you would include the cost of the loss of salmon habitat, because so much of the Snake River is being used to irrigate where the potatoes are grown. If you would include the cost of freezing French fries, it takes 10 times as much energy to produce frozen foods as non-frozen foods. So there's all these externalities that are part of getting French fries to your table or to McDonald's. Maybe that French fry would cost $4. Fewer people would buy French fries. Or how much would gasoline cost if we were to internalize the costs of global warming, of contributing to global warming by driving? See what I'm saying? If the way to come, the way to get different price is simply an information pathway in economics, right? It's a way we try and set a value to something, and then that provides the consumer with information. If the information is shifted so that things cost much differently, then we just start buying differently because the costs are different. And you don't have to necessarily force someone to change. You don't have to even hope for a change of heart. I mean, I think people are going to change in a variety of ways. One might be a change of heart by falling in love with all creation, such that we want to live in a way that's more balanced. Another way would be by government regulation. Governments charging, you know, just saying we're going to charge $5 a gallon for gas, and we're going to use that money to help ameliorate our contributions to global warming. These types of policies would begin to create a system that would send different information down the line. One other example, the gross domestic product. The gross domestic product goes up and we're all happy. The gross domestic product is simply a measure of flows of goods and services through the economy. It's a measure of its exchange of money. So you have divorce and the GDP goes up often because you've got one household becoming two. You've got lawyer's fees. When you have environmental degradation, it often increases GDP. Because you've got to go out and clean it up, and that costs money. Exxon Valdez oil spills increase the GDP. So there's this article in Atlantic Monthly years ago, if the GDP is up, why is America down? And it cited all the things that we tend to think of not, that we don't value, and said, if GDP is up, shouldn't all these other things be getting better as well, like divorce, like teenage suicide, teenage pregnancies, these sort of social indicators of well-being. So there's a different model. We could create a different way of simply measuring economic wealth. And there's a group doing it, a group in California called Redefining Progress. They've developed a genuine progress indicator. So there's GDP, how about GPI, genuine progress indicator. They subtract for things like the cost, social cost of divorce. They subtract the ecological cost of Exxon Valdez oil spills. And they add in volunteer work. So work in the home. That the value of that is added in. Volunteer work in a church is added in. So it's a way to begin to try and put a price tag on things that really are priceless, but that so that the economy would begin to recognize them. The GPI, Genuine Progress Indicator, has gone down 42%, I believe it is, since 1970. So if you put the GDP, you know, it's still going up, the GPI has gone down since 1972. If that was our measure of economic well-being, politicians would not be saying, what a great economy we have. They'd be figuring out how to shift our policies so that the GPI would be going up instead of the GDP. It's such an abstraction, it seems to me. So those are some, I mean, I guess to get at your question, some of those ways might be seen as forcing. Some might be seen as government regulation. Some might be come through a change of heart, increased awareness. I think there's a variety of ways we might get there.
Well, what I hear you saying is increased awareness of the hidden costs in production, say, of a commodity, like food, for example. The cost of the water that goes into it, which is supported by taxpayers, but most people aren't aware that they are paying, you know, something extra there when they buy that food. And they don't get a printout which says, so much of this cost, this food, was due to the water that you are supporting through taxation, you know, supply for the growing of the crop.
Well, so I'm saying yes, increased awareness would be part of it, and that would be a part of what would help shift individual choices and also potentially begin to provide enough political will so that larger policies would shift. But also we could simply begin to, again, create the political will to support the idea of a GPI, let's say. And certainly then this group in California is trying to get the senators and congresspeople and talk about the GPI. Go ahead, yeah.
Well, I live in a cooperative where people who are 55 years of age or older, and we have an environmental committee sitting around a little table, you know, talking. But every time we meet, we bring an article about the environment, and, you know, so we discuss different things, making an awareness of what, you know, what is happening to our environment. And the one thing that was brought out this last meeting we had was the need for education. And that's what I hear you saying now, that people are not aware of a lot of these things, or if they are, they haven't internalized it yet. And so even in our little cooperative, we've decided that there are ways that we can. We're going to brainstorm on how we can do some education.
Well, I think education is crucial. But it's not just education of facts. It somehow has to be education of the heart. That calls us from a deep place of relationship, you know, with God and with all creation, or whatever the language might be. And for those who just, I mean, there are ways to sort of to change the culture so that people begin to learn differently, where you don't have to educate person by person, and that's what I'm hoping for in terms of policy shifts, so that if our taxes were different, people's behaviors would just change. Taxes not only collect revenue, they also set policy, and there are ways we could do that without having to have every heart changed.
Yes.
I think we need to move faster than that.
Yeah, well, that's that was the one thing that I thought of too. It seems like it would be such a slow way for that.
But it's part and parcel,
it's a beginning.
And it's part of creating the political will to have those policies change.
Yeah.
You know, around election time,
We want to assess one of you with their...
I was just going to say, we were in Australia before the Olympics, and it was amazing what they had done when they made the Olympic Village. First of all, they drained the swamp and cleaned it all out, and it looked like our ditches, which they pulled out of it. There's not one single electric wire. They have solar heating throughout the whole thing. and they have these batteries, you know, that they're recharged. The water is collected off the roofs. They have a special drainage system where when it rains, they collect it and recycle it. It is just incredible. Do you know about that?
I hadn't heard about that part of it, no.
And they are not going to trash it. They didn't trash it after the games were over. That it was to become another suburb.
Right. So another good example of design.
Yeah, and it was, I don't know if they had a heart change or what they did, but obviously it had something to do with economy.
Yeah, and certainly businesses are beginning to realize that they can still make profit by, I mean, it makes sense.
The economy of the rainwater was the most incredible thing.
And the economy is finally dependent upon a healthy ecosystem, finally. It is. We are all ultimately dependent on that. Anyone else have said anything yet?
I have. And one of my major concerns is the big conglomerate corporate America. How that is such a stopping point to our economy because it's so controlled by what corporate America wants. And how do we go about changing that? I mean, it definitely, I don't see corporate America having a big heart change here. When they're the ones making money hand over fist, owning McDonald's, or owning Winco, or whatever store it happens to be. Where do we start there? I mean, the only thing that we can do is, as an individual, and change our own lifestyles.
Right. We could also join with others in, I mean, there are groups working to address that question, either through shareholder actions or groups working to educate both the public and policymakers on the corporate charter. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is actually in the corporate charter, and how could it be shifted to be made more responsible, let's say. And I think there's a window for that now because of what's gone on in the last year with Enron's and so on, that people are a little more questioning about the role corporations are playing. I mean, that's a big question and a very important one. If you want to, there's a chapter, Cecile Andrews' chapter in there, has some ideas on the corporate charter and how it might be shifted. Because that would be one more area of policy that would need to be significantly addressed.
Changed.
Yes, exactly. So, and well, yeah, go ahead, Dale, you had your hand up earlier, so. And then I think it's about time for dinner, so okay. We need to wrap up.
Very basic to this seems to be our whole relationship with food, and that is that we have, I think, come to believe that more and more is better and better, and the portions in restaurants get bigger, and we tend to eat more and more. The old practice, and I'm just playing with this in my mind, I don't have a place to go with it, but the old practice of fasting, I think, helped to teach that one didn't have to have food as much as we think. It gives a time in which you experience being present without eating, which has in it, I think, a setting free from believing that every 3 hours we need to stuff ourselves. And so maybe something as basic as that. And they, what I understand is corporations respond to consumers. And if somehow we change the whole way of relating to food, I think we could affect that. We also have corporations like in Portland, we have Nature's, a store that really tries to look at other values in foods. Mm-hmm. And they've started several of them. They're creating a chain. And if there was support for that kind of thing, I think they would help promote different values.
Yeah, in Seattle we have Future Consumer Co-op, BCCs, that do the same thing. And food. I mean, we could talk about corporate culture in a variety of ways, and one of them might be through the window of agribusiness. There are about six companies now that control majority of the agricultural transactions in the world, essentially. And what we're finding is that they're vertically integrated. So they're owning the seeds, they own the land in which the seeds are grown, they own the inputs that they sell to farmers, they own the processing plants that the farmer delivers the seed to, they own the plants that create the food, and they sometimes own the grocery stores. I mean, that's what vertical integration is what they're wanting, from seed to table.
ADM.
From ADM, Cargill, Monsanto. Again, we need to recognize that there is perhaps embodied evil within the institution, that the people there are not bad people, that we need to go forward together. And certainly food may be the one, the three times a day choice we make, at least, to make a daily difference. And certainly, Earth Ministry's got this little book, Food, Faith, and Sustainability. And in 6 weeks or so, a book like Simpler Living's coming out called Food and Faith that will get at just these kinds of ideas, both the fasting, you know, the spirituality of food, the sacramental nature of food. I mean, just think about it. We celebrate every week. Bread and wine is the way through which we perhaps most intimately connect to God's incarnation in the world in our rituals. And so there's and the deep traditions of hospitality and communion around food, but then also goes into the issues of the increased consolidation of food, control of land, how far food travels, the loss of the family farm. And there's a study guide within it to help people create community around those issues, and then how could we then shift our patterns to create a more sustainable world. So with that, perhaps we should close as we need to go eat.
Our third meal.
Yeah. I tell you, I'm really hungry.
Talking about all this food.
Yeah, I know. But thanks for coming.